Considering that Brush Creek runs right through the heart of the city and carries our sewage, we don't think a whole lot about it except when it floods. It's been almost 20 years since the flood of 98, but the really big Brush Creek flood was during the stormy September of 1977. In a grainy old Channel 9 newscast, you can see cars submerged in greenish-brown water, people walking neck-deep in it trying to salvage things from their homes, and sandbagging efforts in progress. The news anchor gave a somber recap.
It was Sunday night that much of Kansas City was awakened by constant rumbling thunder and pulsating lightning that accompanied a heavy downpour. By sunup Monday, several areas in the metropolitan region had received up to 6 inches of rain. Monday remained overcast for the most part, but the heavy rains had stopped during the day. At sunset, the drizzle again began, and it increased to light rain, then got heavier until it came down as a blinding torrent. The tragic results you already know.
More than 40 years later, a rainy September has us thinking about Brush Creek all over again. It's a scenic waterway that provides a nice, lush backdrop for the plaza and other parts of town. But it also has this storied past, some of it much more recent than that flood, as in assessments of E. coli levels that maybe should concern us. I'm Gina Kaufman, and we are talking about Brush Creek on KCUR's Central Standard. Call 816-235-2888 to tell us about the role of Brush Creek in your life. Do you interact with it? Do you want to? 816-235-2888. Let's start with the history. Lynn Youngblood is with us from the Blue River Watershed Association. Hi, Lynn.
Hi.
And Tom Jacobs is the Director of Environmental Programs at MARC, the Mid-America Regional Council. Hi, Tom.
Good morning, Gina.
So first, I want to hear the story of how what was once a natural stream got paved, because it seems like that kind of sets the stage for a lot of what we're going to talk about. Lynn, start us off.
Well, it's a interesting story, and it goes way back to the power years of Tom Pendergast in the early 30s. And he was a big powerhouse in Kansas City, and was not on the city council, but he pretty much bullied the city council, and he was actually the city manager at that time. And he helped formulate what was called the 10-year plan. And for many of you who have been in Kansas City for a while, you may know the Pendergast name, and that he owned a concrete company. And all of the construction, basically in Kansas City, was through Pendergast. And the Ready Mix Cement Company, under Pendergast, he said it would be a really good idea to help with flooding to pave under Brush Creek in the plaza area. So very misguided.
Yeah, I mean, was this... Tom, I want you to put this in the bigger picture of the sort of conventional wisdom of the time. Now we look back on this and say, whoa. But at the time, was that sort of along the lines of what cities were just doing?
I think there are a lot of projects like that around the country where the idea was to move water away from you as quickly as you could. And so if you pave a channel, the water goes away more quickly. And so that there's projects that are like that scattered all around the United States. What's interesting to me is thinking about the natural history of Kansas City. The plaza before it was developed was a giant wetlands, and Brush Creek itself was really just a teeny channel. You could imagine prairie grassland or maybe an oak savanna, and Brush Creek was just a teeny little channel. And as the upper watershed developed, say in Prairie Village or Mission Hills, Fairway, Mission, and in Kansas City, We changed the hydrology of the city, so we're just dumping more water in the creek, and we had to push it down ever faster, and so it resulted in flooding problems like we experienced in 1977.
Give me a bigger picture of how Kansas City was setting up its sewage system in particular at this time.
So as the city's wrestled with its combined sewer problem, they've uncovered Civil War era sewers, and so thinking back 100 or 100 more years ago, the state of the art was just to well, move our sewage away, right? And so thinking about the first experience in London, right, where there were cholera epidemics and they discovered that the source had to do with raw sewage and the environment. And so the idea was to move sewage away and to improve public health.
Wait, this first experience in London, I'm not sure that this is, this seems like something that people in your field maybe all know about, but the rest of us are, can you tell this story?
Well, I don't know that I know all of the details of the story, but think back 150 years ago, there could have been raw discharges of raw sewage into waterways around the world. And so the state of the art in engineering was to capture that and stick it in pipes and then discharge it in areas away from permanent settlements. And so in Kansas City, as we began to build our sewage system, we built combined sewer systems that handled raw sewage as well as stormwater. And that was the state-of-the-art thinking at the time. What changed was the city kept growing, and so the capacity of those sewers to handle the increasing levels of runoff was insufficient.
So did later on, is this part of this decision, part of what played into the floods that we were just hearing about, or no?
Well, it all ties together, right? As you build a city and there's more impervious areas, there's more runoff, and as that level of runoff increases, and as you do things like channelize creeks, the ability of the natural system to absorb water diminishes, and you get opportunities for flash floods to be increasingly impactful.
And Lynn, I mean, tell me more about the ramifications of that decision beyond just flooding issues. What are some of the problems that people did not quite anticipate when they paved Brush Creek, first of all, and second of all, created this combined system of with sewage and stormwater?
Well, it's like what Tom was saying, you know, when you pave over the bottom of a creek, the water cannot seep in. And that's why, you know, all the vegetation is gone because you've paved over it. So those roots cannot absorb the water. And what we have throughout most of the Kansas City area, especially the older parts, are combined sewer systems. So on a dry day, everything's working as it should. So when you flush your toilets, use your sinks and showers and bathtubs, all of that water goes into the drainage pipes and goes to the wastewater treatment plants. When it rains, however, like today, the water drains off. It's called stormwater runoff. It hits the roofs, the pavement, the sidewalks, any impervious surface, and it goes into the storm drains in the streets, and it goes to the sewer pipes or the stormwater pipes. And that water merges with the sewer pipes. And, of course, pipes don't expand. So there's only so much water that can go into those pipes. And then they overflow. And that's how we get raw sewage into our rivers, creeks, and streams. And thereby, that is the problem. So when by Brush Creek, we have raw sewage then flowing into Brush Creek, that's how it got the short name of Flush Creek. And that's how we get so much fecal bacteria into that small creek, which, as Tom described, was just, you know, a tiny little meandering creek originally.
So fecal bacteria in the creek. I mean, the city is built along this creek, and that does seem a little strange considering that it carries our sewage. We have like a big fountain in Brush Creek with the Brush Creek water just east of the plaza. The fact that our sewage does run through this like prestigious shopping and tourist district with where there's now recreation that happens on it, it feels weird to me, but maybe it is less weird than I think it is. Is this unique to Kansas City, or what's the deal?
Pretty much every major metro in the United States has combined sewer problems. And so it's not unique to Kansas City at all. So as we were talking about before, this really was the state-of-the-art thinking going back a couple of generations to build combined sewers. And so it's really a legacy problem, right? You can go even further back and talk mm-hmm. about Pendergast. We can talk about the development of the combined sewer system. So our challenge today is to say, okay, we have this problem. It's particularly noticeable on days that it's raining. If it's dry, the E. coli or fecal coliform levels decline substantially. But we have this problem when it's raining of these elevated bacteria levels in the creek. So how do we fix it?
And
so
What do you think about recreation on Brush Creek? I'm just raising this because I tried to find more current information than this and couldn't, so maybe you can update me. As of 2015, the part of Brush Creek that runs through Missouri was one of many in the state that was unclassified, meaning that the EPA had done no official assessment of whether this particular body of water was safe for recreation. There was actually a lawsuit filed against the EPA for letting so many of its water channels in Missouri go unclassified. Lynn, can you explain that?
Well, I don't know why it is that way, if that's what you're asking.
Oh, no. I mean, I guess, like, explain what the situation is. Like, as an environmentalist, I'm curious about your perspective on whether this is safe for recreation.
It is not safe for recreation. There is a phone app, actually. It's called KC Waterbug. And you can go to any of the rivers in the metro area through this phone app. And it has probes, water quality test probes in the water. And especially during non-frozen days. So typically April through October, let's say. The probes are active, and it will tell you what the water quality is on that given day and what you can do in that water. So, you know, if it can touch your skin, if you can wade in it, swim in it, catch fish, that type of thing. And I don't believe I've ever seen where Brush Creek, you can do anything in it, that the water quality is so poor, you do not even want to wade in it.
So what is going on with all of this right now? I mean, I mentioned that there had been this lawsuit. Like, what is underway right now to kind of improve things?
Oh, there's a tremendous number of things that are underway. Mm-hmm. So I might want to comment quickly on this question of unclassifiable. So there's different sections of the Clean Water Act. And so the section that pertains to combined sewer overflows might relate in some ways, but is a little bit different from the process that the Missouri Department of Natural Resources and EPA would use to determine what are the allowable uses in different waterways. And so there's all kinds of regulatory complications inside of that question. But I think at its heart, right, what we want is the Clean Air Act sets a standard of creating all of our waters to be fishable and swimmable. And so we want clean water. We want our water to become a real asset for the community, a place that folks can enjoy. And so the city has a whole raft of different initiatives underway to clean the water, and we can maybe explore those in more detail in a little bit. But there's watershed studies that are happening in partnership between Kansas City, Missouri, and Johnson County. There's a lot of collaboration that's underway between the Northeast Johnson County cities and Kansas City on Brush Creek, exploring different ecosystem restoration opportunities in different sections of the creek. There's an incredible amount of nonprofit activity. Lynn is a leader in that whole movement, where there's literally thousands of people, not just in Brush Creek, but in Blue River and in other waterways around the metro, where folks are getting together to pick up trash, to clean up the river, to restore riparian or streamside areas, to monitor water quality, to work in schools with kids. So there's a lot going on, and of course there's more to be done for sure.
Well, there's something called the consent decree. Can you tell me about that?
Absolutely. So this the EPA, and under the Clean Water Act, enforces a set of provisions to reduce the volume of combined sewer overflows that enter into waterways in Kansas City or in any metro areas around the country. And so there's a set of standards that are inside of the Clean Water Act. And so the city initiated about a five-year process of community engagement under then Mayor Kay Barnes. There was a wet weather community panel. There were a set of recommendations that were formulated. The city, together with its consulting team, put a plan together. They then worked with EPA and Missouri Department of Natural Resources and the Department of Justice to get a shared vision of how that plan would be implemented, and that was codified in a consent decree, which was a 25-year plan that laid out exactly what the city was going to do to comply with the Clean Water Act provisions for combined sewers.
So what year are we on, 8 or so?
We were just talking about that. I think it was finalized in 2010, but between 2008 and 2010.
So if we have 25 years from the start to get into compliance with just sort of the health and environment, I guess, standards of our time, that means that, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but it sounds to me like we're just going to be living with an insufficiently clean creek running through our city for up to 17 more years. Is that fair or not?
It is fair, but it's worth offering a little bit more nuance, I think.
Yeah, please.
So if it takes generations to build a city with a certain kind of infrastructure, it's incredibly expensive to change that infrastructure over to meet a new standard. And so the consent decree has provisions in it that will require the city to spend about $4.5 billion to solve this problem. And so it's the biggest public works project perhaps in the history of the city. And to be able to get that done,
People's
expensive.
Water bills have gone up and
right.
all of that.
Right. And so there's all kinds of issues around affordability and social equity that come into play. And then thinking about, well, how can we formulate solutions that are meaningful to the community and at the same time meet the water quality standards that are included in the consent decree?
Well, what are your thoughts about how you would advise people to behave around Brush Creek while it's getting cleaned up?
I mean, that's a great question. And I know that the Mid-America Regional Council has done surveys of the public. And one of the things that always rates the very highest is water quality, which is kind of interesting when you see the things that they survey the general public on. And so people care about the water. And people do have opportunities that they can affect water quality on their own. So one very simple thing they can do is if they have a pet, whether it's a dog or a cat, if they just pick up the pet waste. And it sounds kind of interesting because many people say, well, dog poop is fertilizer, but it's not. You know, even though it's...
Gasp, I thought it was.
Right. So even though it's manure, it's not... It contains meat byproducts and things like that. So it's not fertilizer. And anything that's on the ground ends up in the water. Anything that is on the ground ends up in the water. And so when it rains, whether it's a big poop plop or it has already degraded into molecules of poop, the rainwater will pick it up and take it to the water. And that's what adds to the fecal bacteria. And Kansas Cityans have a lot of dogs and cats. And so people need to pick up after their pets. And once they truly understand how that is assisting in poor water quality, I think more people will do it. Another thing is people don't understand or don't read the directions on their fertilizer bags. So they get out their big fertilizer spreader, they pour the bag in there, they spread it across their lawn, and when the bin is empty, they just pour more fertilizer in it. And they keep fertilizing until the bin is done and they've walked across their yard and they're done. And that excess fertilizer just runs off and goes into the stream. And, you know, what does fertilizer do? It turns grass green. So when that excess fertilizer goes into the water, it makes algae and other things turn green, which absorbs all the oxygen. Well, fish and other aquatic animals need that oxygen. And so it depletes the streams of oxygen, and it also helps cloud the water, like silt and other things that get into the water. So when you're gardening or doing construction, if you don't have construction fences, that adds to it. So when I am teaching a class for school children and I talk to them about these kind of things and I say, so if you're outside in the summer and you're barefoot and your feet are burning in the sun, are you going to jump onto the sidewalk to cool your feet or the asphalt? Which one?
The sidewalk or the asphalt are my only two choices?
Right.
I don't like these two choices one bit.
Which one are you going to jump on?
I guess the sidewalk. I don't know.
Right. The sidewalk, because it's white and it's cooler than that black asphalt.
Right.
That's the same thing.
But I would prefer something else altogether. Neither one sounds good.
But the the sidewalk is cooler because it's white. The asphalt is hotter because it's black. That's what happens with the stream. So a clear stream is cooler, but a stream that has silt and extra fertilizer in it, and so now it's green and cloudy, is going to be hotter. And that's what's killing the fish and the aquatic animals and the aquatic plants.
Lynn, how close would you say, you've said that you don't think that Brush Creek is safe for recreation. How close would you recommend people, like, draw the line as far as, I mean, as long as people aren't in the water, do you think that that's healthy or no?
Well, you know, some people will say, well, even if I go canoeing on it, can I do that? But when you're like paddling, as the paddle crosses the boat, the water will drip into the boat. And so, it depends, like, are you sitting in the boat? Are you kneeling in the boat? You know, so it just depends on what you're doing.
Well, more on where things stand with Brush Creek right now in just a minute. Call 816-235-2888 to talk to us about the role of Brush Creek in Kansas City in your life. 816-235-2888. We're going to get to those calls right after this break. I'm Gina Kaufman. Don't go away. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and I've been talking with Lynn Youngblood of the Blue River Watershed Association and Tom Jacobs of the Mid-America Regional Council about Brush Creek. From contamination to environmental hazards and legendary flooding, the challenges of this waterway are many, and they're serious, but Brush Creek is also a scenic backdrop for life in Kansas City. It's become a place for recreation and big events. How do we sort out the different functions of this creek, manage its dangers, and also enjoy living and working alongside it? 816-235-2888 is the number to call. And I'm going to take a quick call from Bob in Lake Quivira. Hi, Bob.
Hi.
What do you want to share?
Well, I know our water systems are huge. All of our water in this area is trying to drain into the Missouri River. And that affects a huge regional area around Kansas City and can affect Brush Creek directly also. So my question is, what's being done on a wide regional basis to control runoff and water problems, especially in view of some of the huge developments that are going on around the outskirts of Kansas City?
Well, okay. I'm going to start by letting Tom Jacobs of the Mid-America Regional Council talk about regional coordination on this, and then I'm going to introduce another guest who might have some additional things to share.
Fantastic. Well, it's a great question. It's one that we've worked really hard on for a long time to try and figure out how to approach development and stormwater runoff and environmental protection in ways that make sense. And so maybe 15 years or so ago, we developed a series of three or four different tools that have really guided the way most city and county governments address this issue. We revised engineering standards for stormwater management to try and protect water quality and reduce flooding. We developed a set of planning guidelines that are useful for site design for new developments for a residential or commercial project to try and think about how to integrate nature into the way that's done so we can soak more water into the ground. Most communities around the metro have adopted stream protection ordinances, so to back developments away from creeks to reduce the risks of flooding, while at the same time creating opportunities for having beautiful trails along those places and improving habitat and water quality. So we've done a lot of those things, and increasingly the new trend is towards what we're calling integrated watershed management. And so we're trying to look at whole watersheds, say the 30 or so square miles that comprise the Brush Creek watershed from the city of Mission down to where Brush Creek flows into the Blue River a few miles east of the plaza. And we're asking the question, how does growth and development affect these issues? What are the opportunities for mitigating potential impacts and for using natural systems the protection of natural systems as a strategy for improving overall quality of life while addressing water quality and quantity kinds of issues? So we're in the process of of moving towards that approach. We're looking at the standards again. And so it's sort of an iterative process where I think we get better and better over time.
Lynn, before we move on to our next guest, just a reminder to people of the just how big of a presence Brush Creek does have in our city and our watershed. Tom just referred to all the different communities that would be part of that watershed. But do people realize just, I mean, it's such a prominently visible piece of creek right by the plaza, but it goes through much more of the city than that.
Yes, I think, you know, to most of Kansas Cityans, I think if you say, where is Brush Creek, they'll say the plaza. And, you know, east or west of that, I think they'll just kind of go, huh? But Brush Creek really starts in Kansas, and it begins just north of 63rd Street by the Kansas City Country Club, and that has a small tributary that's unnamed that merges with it by Belinder. And then as it goes through the plaza, it continues east and runs into the Blue River.
Let's talk with Tom Kimes on this issue of just our water management overall, and especially stormwater management. He is the manager of stormwater utility engineering for the Kansas City Water Department. Hi, Tom.
Good morning.
So let's talk about, first of all, the answer to Bob's question.
If you want to think about Brush Creek and where it fits in the bigger picture, it is part of the Blue River watershed. Blue River watershed is about 289 square miles, so it's a very large area. The Blue River is split about 50-50 between the Kansas side and the Missouri side, with the Kansas side being the uphill part, Missouri side being the downhill side that flows eventually into the Missouri River. So if you look at your hand, you think about your hand. The lower part of your hand is the lower part of a watershed. And as your fingers go up, those are all the little tributaries that feed into that system. And so as they contribute, that water accumulates. Brush Creek is about one-tenth of that. It's about one-tenth of the Blue River.
And so what is being done thinking about development along Brush Creek and thinking about its role in part of this larger system? What is the sort of big picture coordination taking place right now? Anything that the other Tom did not already mention?
We've had what's called the Brush Creek Coordinating Committee for many years. So after the 1977 flood, the Mid-America Regional Council requested the Corps of Engineers to become involved and look to see if there was a flood control project that could benefit the communities. And they looked all over the watershed, the entire watershed. There were damages. There were damages in Kansas. There were damages all the way up to the Blue River. They did an analysis, and they identified flood control project. The first project and the only project that they were able to get a positive benefit-cost ratio, which is a federal criteria for a flood control project, was the plaza, and that was because of all the commercial losses there. And there were other commercial districts that are affected as well, but they didn't have as much damage. So if you think about a city, if you're familiar with Tulsa, a flatter city, when it floods, everybody floods. Floods all over the place. Kansas City's a hilly community. So the areas that flood are really close to the river itself. So that's how the plaza got flooded so much. And there are a few things that contributed to that. So they started a project. They initiated the project. It started construction in the 1990s. It was completed in the 1990s. And that's what people are familiar with, is the plaza project. But since that time, we've been continuing to work. There was a plan that was developed at the time. It was named after Mayor Cleaver, Cleaver was mayor at the time of Kansas City. And they developed what was called the Cleaver Plan. And that plan identified many other projects and the idea of addressing all of Brush Creek on the Kansas City, Missouri side. In partnership with Johnson County, we continue to have meetings. There's issues in Kansas as well, and communities in Kansas partner with us. They're working on projects as well. One of the projects we're working on is looking at State Line Road Bridge, which Mission Hills partners with us on that, as well as Johnson County.
So State Line Road Bridge, where is that exactly?
State Line Road Bridge crosses over Brush Creek. So if you can kind of think about there's a tennis club right there and a couple of golf courses nearby, right on State Line near Pembroke Hill School.
Why is that of particular interest, that location?
There are many locations that are of interest, but that location, City of Mission Hills, actually identified that they had some concerns about the bridge and whether or not the bridge was being damaged by flooding. So what's happened over time, what happens with many urban streams, is people modify it. So they come in, they take bends of the river out so it has less distance to travel. They may modify it, they may change the banks, build stone walls on the sides, put concrete in the bottom so water starts traveling faster. When water travels faster, it becomes more erosive. If it finds a soft spot in the bank, it'll start eroding that spot. So that's kind of what's happening in that area. So we're working with the Johnson County communities, and we're also working with the Corps of Engineers to look at solutions to protect that bridge in that area.
You know, I mean, I want to just talk to you as a person who lives here. In your perfect life scenario, in your dream world, what do we do with Brush Creek as a city? How do we relate to it? What's its condition? How, you know, could you have a dream for Brush Creek as a person?
I do. And I live in the watershed. And I work in rivers because I love rivers. So I view Kansas City as, you think about, each city has some kind of geographic aspect to it that makes it unique. And in the Midwest, it's our rivers, and we are a river city. And it's not something that we've thought about, I think, a lot as Kansas Cityans, as being a river city, because our rivers have been wild. Think about the Missouri River. People say, why wasn't the Missouri Riverfront developed? It's because it flooded all the time. Things that were down there got swept away, got flooded on a pretty frequent basis. So people kind of stayed away from it. It's the same of Brush Creek. It's the same of Blue River. People were staying away from it. They saw it as something that was unpredictable and difficult to work with. So it was kind of ignored. And then, as you heard earlier, discussion about just using it as an open sewer. So people said, well, we'll just route everything down there. People don't really want to go down there. It'll flood unpredictably. We'll just let our sewage go down there. But over time, we've realized that it's actually an asset. And as we've modified it, and now we intercept that sewage, so it's not flowing directly into Brush Creek, except in rare cases. And so now we look at it, we have the ability to start looking at it as a community asset. It can be the focal point. It could be an opportunity for people to learn about the natural world. As a person who lives in an urban space, I miss the natural world sometimes. And so I want to be able to go somewhere close by that I can say, I can see some nature.
And this creek is right there.
The creek is right there. And I think people think that it's heavily polluted and that it's a dead creek. And in fact, that's not true. I've gone down there. I've seen crayfish in the creek. I was actually giving a tour to some people that came in and they wanted to see the Brush Creek Flood Control Project. And right there on the bank of the creek was a turtle that was probably about 2 feet across. Turtle's a predator. It has to have something to eat. So there's something living in that creek that turtle was eating. So that says that there is something alive in that creek.
But is something being alive the measure of, like, this is not polluted? Just that something can stay alive?
It's not. There are species that are more tolerant to pollutants and some that are less tolerant. And so the fewer, more sensitive species you see, the more pollution there is.
I like this idea of thinking of Brush Creek as a place that Kansas Cityans in the urban environment could go to be close to nature. But Lynn, I am curious about your response to Tom's statement that this isn't as polluted as people think.
Well, I'm curious about it too. So, I'm really kind of dumbstruck. So would you go wading in that?
No, to say that there's life in the creek is not the same thing to say that it's safe for full body contact.
Okay.
But we have bald eagles on Lower Brush Creek that hunt in the creek. They find fish in the creek. Bald eagle is a big predator. It has to find something to eat. Mm-hmm. We know that they're there. We see them. You can drive down the parkway and you can actually see them roosting in the trees looking for fish.
I mean, I am glad to hear that, but this is not the measure of, like, this is a place that I, as a human with knowledge of E. coli levels, am going to go hang out. That's the difference here?
That is the difference. Wildlife is going to be opportunistic. If they see water, they're not going to take out a test kit and test to see what the pollutants in it are. But if they can survive in it and thrive, they will try to do so.
Well, so I do want to ask this question of our other two guests. Lynn, what is your perfect, like, vision for Brush Creek and the way we relate to it as a city in dreamland?
Well, my perfect vision would be to take out the concrete from the bottom. And I know that's been discussed, but I haven't been there for those discussions. So I don't know what the outcome is of those discussions. I know right now it's just to leave it there. And Tom, I don't know what you have heard, what you've heard about that, but I would love to see the concrete taken out and just let it go back to its true state.
That seems like an ambitious project if we're exiting dreamland.
Yeah.
And that's the problem?
Yeah.
Tom, what about you? Other Tom, Tom Jacobs of Mark.
So it's fun to think about Brush Creek as an asset, right? And all the different ways it can contribute to the quality of life in the plaza or in the whole watershed. Mm-hmm. So it's a place where there could be a lot of things that live. There could be a lot of commercial activity. People can walk on the trails. It can be a rich and healthy habitat. It can be something that just creates vitality in a space. Mm-hmm. And so broadening out the perspective just from Brush Creek, we can think about managing water and streamways and natural resources across the region as elements of a city that really create vitality and health. And whether it's economic health or it's ecological health or public health or just, you know, cool places you want to hang out. And there's opportunities to do that all over the place. And I think the Brush Creek is perhaps the most iconic or visible of those kinds of opportunities, but there's opportunities all over. And it's important for us to be a resilient city and to be a sustainable city.
Well, I'm Gina Kaufman. There's still just a little bit more time for this conversation. We'll be right back. Plus, before we go today, this week's must-see events at the Open Spaces Festival. That's all coming up. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking about Brush Creek with Lynn Youngblood, a local environmentalist, Tom Jacobs of Mark, and Tom Kimes with us from the city's water department. We've been looking at history. We've been looking at flooding, paving, sanitation, recreation. And guys, is there something that we have not discussed that you think we really ought to?
I think, you know, when we were just closing before the break, we were talking about our dream or our perfect world. And Tom Jacobs and Tom Kimes and I, we all work together on various different committees and planning and things like that. And I know that one thing that has come up through a lot of our different community meetings is that for the most part, or at least I feel, and it's come up during meetings, that for many people in Kansas City, our rivers are invisible. And, you know, we're trying to bring, as Tom Jacobs said earlier, we're trying to bring our rivers to life. And in the 20s and 30s, the rivers were very important to people. And they did a lot of recreating on them. And it would be so fabulous to get our rivers to the point where we were back to that point.
Explain the connection with Brush Creek.
So let's say that the dream became reality, where there were, you know, picture New York with its little, you know, stands selling hot dogs and ice cream and things like that all along Brush Creek. And, you know, maybe we had paddle boats with people, you know, renting paddle boats and canoes, and there were swans or whatever, you know, swimming around. And
so this is a future where an E. coli is not an issue.
That's right. And, you know, it was the go-to place in Kansas City. And it spread so that it was happening on the Blue River and Tomahawk Creek and Indian Creek. But it starts at Brush Creek. And people suddenly realize what an asset our rivers are in Kansas City.
So the creek leads them to the river just like it leads water to the river.
That's right.
Tom Jacobs, I mean, do you see a realistic pathway from here to this vision that Lynn has just laid out?
I absolutely do. It's interesting. I think we're kind of at an inflection point. There's a lot of energy around protecting streams and protecting the environment and thinking about how we grow as a city and how we can manage water as part of that process. And so I can see opportunities all over the place to make things better. Things sometimes are incremental in terms of process, but there's, you know, right off the top, I can think of 10 different projects that are underway that all have a lot of positive momentum associated with them that take us there step by step. I know Lynn might have 4,000 kids in the creek every year. We're testing about water quality. There's three or four or five other nonprofits that have literally thousands of volunteers cleaning up creeks and contributing to the benefit of our streams and waterways and environment. And then thinking about the connectivity between our streams and the various neighborhoods that surround the creek and the watershed, and the opportunities to link the revitalization or the development of those places in ways that are positive for the river and positive for those communities.
Even including like reorienting some of the activity, because right now a lot of communities that are sort of abutting a waterway kind of have their backs really faced to those waterways.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Just like Tom was talking about before for the Missouri River, you know, people always said we've always turned our back on the river. So how do we engage with rivers or streams or natural resources in ways that are creative, interactive, positive, add value to the community, to our lives?
Tom Kimes, another thought from you?
Lynn had brought up a point earlier, and I think it's really an important one, is the city's doing quite a bit and other communities are doing quite a bit. But it's important, I think, for people to think about what they can do themselves. So thinking about picking up dog waste, any trash that falls on the ground that doesn't get picked up, it'll eventually end up in our waterways. Leaves, brush that people push into our curb inlets, those get washed down. So each of those can contribute to degradation of our waterways. So there's things people can do in their own yard to help improve the water.
And I'll just add my favorite one in terms of the list of things that people can do. Plant a tree. Trees are incredibly valuable for sucking water up, for cleaning water, for cleaning the air, for creating habitat, for making streets more walkable. Plant a tree. If everybody plants a tree, it'll make the city a better place.
Plant a tree for Brush Creek?
Absolutely.
Well, we are going to have to wrap up our conversation, but keep talking about Brush Creek because it is not going anywhere. It is running right through our city, and it shapes a lot of what we do and how we live. Lynn Youngblood, Tom Jacobs, Tom Kimes, thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, before we go, our weekly guide to the Open Spaces Festival, this time with KCUR contributor Ann Kniggendorf. Hi, Ann.
Hi, Gina.
What are you looking forward to at the Open Spaces Festival right now?
Well, I found out about two very cool things in the past week. One is an exhibition called Break Into Blossom. It's a collaboration between Sarah and Fong Wen. They're a married couple who live in Colombia. But the really cool thing about this is that it is like it's ultra mixed media. The exhibition came out of a short story that Fong wrote in 2011 called Einstein Saves Hiroshima. And the Wing Luke Museum in Seattle.
Wait. I need you to tell me a little bit about this story.
Okay, this whole thing
is based on it.
Right. It ended up in a collection that was published in 2014 called Pages from the Textbook of Alternate History. And it's like a wish fulfillment book. So it looks at things that could have happened but didn't. So one of the examples Fong gives is that Hitler applied to art school twice. So in this book, Hitler gets into art school. And so in this one also, apparently Einstein spent his life feeling terrible that he'd endorsed this nuclear project. And so it ended up with the backing of the government, the development of Little Boy for World War II. So it comes from that short story.
So is this a short story wherein Einstein makes a different decision?
Yes.
Gotcha.
In this short story, Einstein doesn't sign the paper and the bombs can't be developed. So when they drop it, it's a dud. It didn't have the backing. It didn't have research money, so it doesn't go off.
It doesn't have science.
No science, no money.
Well, so what is the art project for Open Spaces that is based on this short story? I am super intrigued.
Well, an Asian American museum called the Wing Luke in Seattle called Fong and said, we want something for our museum. And so his wife, who is a mixed media artist, developed an exact replica of Little Boy with the help of artist Justin Shaw in Warrensburg. And it's, I mean, to the inch. This thing is to the inch, it's Little Boy. And right now it's at the Truman Library. And so what she did with it, what Sarah Wen did with it, was make it rusty. So it's this huge rusty Little Boy replica, and it has lichen, it has moss, and her thing is to the way people can interact with it, because most Open Spaces installments have some element of audience interaction. She's also cut out thousands of cherry blossoms, because her idea was that it crashed through a cherry grove, and you know, ground into the ground, and it's just sitting there, and it's been there for decades. So people can take a little cherry blossom and write their wishes on it for peace. The ones I saw at Truman Library were things like impeach Trump. I took a picture, so I'll have that up on September 14th. Or I'll have some photos of people's wishes.
At kcur.org.
That's right.
So what else are you looking forward to?
Well, something I didn't know about until last week when KCUR's Laura Spencer pointed it out was that the 21C Hotel has salons. And I had not noticed that in the Open Spaces booklet. But there these discussions every Thursday evening that started last Thursday and go through October 25th.
So salons like not for hair cutting?
Not for hair cutting. Salons for talking about things. And the one tomorrow is discussing an author named Vincent O. Carter. He's a Kansas City author who died in the 60s, and he died in Switzerland as an expatriate. And the panelists for that will be Whitney Terrell, Glenn North, and Sherry Hall. And the discussion is moderated by Dan Cameron, the artistic director of Open Spaces. And the book is Such Sweet Thunder.
Well, yeah, and those are all three pretty heavy-hitting local authors, people we've interviewed on this show.
Right.
It's an exciting opportunity.
Yeah, it really is, and it's a Kansas City book, and it wasn't published until 2004, so a publishing house found it after he had died, and Whitney Terrell actually has a really good review of it on the New York Times website, if anybody's interested in reading that before they go to the salon.
So after this thing has been going for a couple of weeks, I am also curious whether anything you've already seen has surprised you or caught your attention in a way that maybe you hadn't anticipated.
Well, I really like the interactive aspects of all of the things that I have seen. And when I first started researching Break into Blossom, the one at Truman Library, I didn't realize by looking at the booklet that it was based on a short story. So I thought that was really great, and that it was such a collaboration between this husband-wife team. And so then that makes it seem like an even bigger project. And then when you bring in also the public to write on the cherry blossoms, it's just so collaborative. So that was a nice surprise to find out about.
I don't mean to give away your secrets, but when we did our live broadcast from the park, I know that you had a little difficulty finding exactly where we were. And I will acknowledge that I had some difficulty finding the beginning of a self-guided tour. And I'm just wondering if you're finding your way through this better and better as you make second trips and third trips, because that's part of it, right?
I am. Yeah, I think I can find my way better each time, but an address sure does help.
It is just interesting that we are getting to know this park better as part of it.
Right. And all the way out to Truman Library.
Well, Anne Kniggendorf, thank you so much for being here today.
Yeah, thank you, Gina.
Anne's reviews and stories are at kcur.org. Check them out. She'll have that photo she was talking about in about a week. And that's a wrap for KCUR's Central Standard this morning. If you didn't catch our in-depth discussion of life along Brush Creek and everything that's happening with that, you can grab it at kcur.org/Central Standard later today. And that goes for any of our past shows, including yesterday's conversation about tailgating in Kansas City, why we do it so passionately. And there's more to it than you might think. KCUR.org/Central Standard. Tomorrow, our series on first-time voters continues with some people who are headed to the polls for the first time because they've been incarcerated in past elections. Tune in for that tomorrow at 10. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Melody Rowell with Coy Duggar, Kathleen Pointer, and Suzanne Hogan. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer, and I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next.